This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we welcome Dr. Salim Lamrani, a researcher on Cuban-U.S. relations.
And in his new book, Superpower Principles, U.S. Terrorism Against Cuba, the case which is called the great scandal of the 21st century, the case of the Cuban Five, is explored in detail.
We'll also interview Bob Fitrakis about the push in Ohio to destroy the 2004 election ballots.
If they can destroy him, the real winner of the Ohio race will never be known. This is precisely what the pro-American reactionary government in Mexico is trying to do to prevent the socialist candidate, Luis Obrador, from gaining office after he clearly won the majority of the Mexican votes.
We'll also hear excerpts from a speech by Foreign Minister Felipe Roque of Cuba.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Director of the USA Program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
We'd like to welcome our new affiliate, Radio Free Moscow, KRFP 92.5 in Moscow, Idaho.
Michael, I understand there was a famous post-9/11 civil liberties case that came out of Moscow, Idaho. Tell our listeners about it.
You know, when I heard that Radio Free Moscow was joining us, I was very excited because I remember in the early days after 9/11, an outrageous case that came out of the University of Idaho, which is in Moscow. And it was one of those early so-called terrorist prosecutions. And there was a 34-year-old doctoral student at University of Moscow. And they accused him, John Ashcroft did, of materially aiding terrorism. And the evidence was extremely, I mean, to say thin would be an exaggeration. The guy was helping with some websites of some Muslim charities. And supposedly some people involved in those Muslim charities, not in the charities, but in the website or posting things, posted something the government didn't like or from some organizations that this guy obviously knew nothing about or had nothing to do with. But they indicted the guy for materially aiding terrorism in Moscow, Idaho, and they jailed him for a very long time. This 34-year-old doctoral student, his name was Sami Husayan. And they actually, it went so far as to actually go to a trial in Moscow, Idaho. And you had, of course, people standing on the rooftop saying, you see, there's sleeper cells all over the country. They're in Moscow, Idaho. It's a demonstration to me of how, you know, what this government is doing around terrorism touches everybody and affects everybody. In any case, I won't keep you waiting. The jury actually acquitted the guy of any charges of terrorism. And they quoted one of the jurors, I think it was 2003 or 2004. The juror said, quote, "There was not a word spoken that indicated he supported terrorism. It was a real stretch." So there you go. Yeah. We welcome Radio Free Moscow. We're glad to have you with us. And particularly for this show, we're proud that the jurors of Moscow saw through the government's lies and acquitted the University of Idaho student.
Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky, Nobel laureate Nadine Gordimer, Michael Parenti, Len Wineglass, and our own Michael Smith, intellectual luminaries spell out the grim realities of U.S. aggressions against Cuba since 1898. In 1959, with the triumph of the Cuban Revolution, Washington implemented international terrorism as a tool of its foreign policy, and violence against Cuba has become a doctrinal norm in world affairs. The fate of the Cuban Five, who traveled to the U.S. to investigate terrorist groups in Florida, and then received life sentences for doing so, is also reviewed in the new book, Superpower Principles, U.S. Terrorism Against Cuba, edited by Dr. Salim Lamrani. Dr. Salim Lamrani is a researcher at the Paris 7 and a graduate of the Sorbonne University of Paris. He's a specialist in U.S.-Cuban relations since 1959 and has written numerous articles, translated in several languages, and published all around the world. Salim, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Salim, could you tell us a bit about your background and how you became interested in your field of expertise, U.S. relations with Cuba?
Yeah, I'm a researcher at Paris University, Denis Diderot University, and I'm specialized on U.S.-Cuban relations since 1959, since the Cuban Revolution. And I got interested in U.S.-Cuba relations by reading books from Noam Chomsky. I got interested in U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America. And when I discovered the case of Cuba, it was illuminating, if we can say that. So it's a very interesting history, and that's why I decided to specialize on U.S.-Cuba relations.
Salim, the number of people and the really moral status of the authors that you've gotten to contribute to your book is really quite extraordinary. One of them in particular I know of, Ignacio Ramonet, is the editor of Le Monde Diplomatique. Another is the attorney for the Cuban Five, who is really one of the most prestigious constitutional lawyers here in the United States. Ramonet says in his chapter that the Cuban Five's imprisonment is one of the biggest legal scandals of the beginning of the 21st century. Len Wineglass goes on to explain why. He says the Five were not prosecuted because they violated American law, but because their work exposed those who were. By infiltrating the terror network that is allowed to exist in Florida, they demonstrated the hypocrisy of America's claimed opposition to terrorism. And after reading 16 chapters of the book, to my view, that was really the essence of what you've been able to accomplish here in pulling this book together. Heidi and I were wondering, because we know in the United States, unfortunately, there's been really not much discussion of this great 21st century scandal. Back in France, in Paris, where you come from, what's it like there?
You know, this case, the case of U.S. terrorism against Cuba and the case of the Cuban Five, also had been completely silenced by the French press. The French press even took indecency to call Luis Posada Carriles, who is the worst terrorist of the Western Hemisphere, they call him an anti-Castro militant. They also called him a person accused of terrorism. They also used the expression an ex-terrorist. I didn't know there was a prescription for terrorist activities. I'm wondering what would happen if we called Osama bin Laden an anti-Bush militant or a person accused of terrorism or an ex-terrorist. So we can say that in a certain way, the French media are accomplices of terrorism, considering that for them, the attacks against Cuba are not important. So whenever possible, crimes committed against Cuba are kept silent. And when it's not possible, they are minimized, and the culprits and the criminals responsible for those acts are acquitted by the media with total impunity, as it is shown by the way they call Luis Posada Carriles. So the media accepts to justify a certain type of violence and denounce what they call arbitrary terrorism. It all depends, in my opinion, on who the victim is. If it is European or American, then the obviously the culprits are criminals without a gun or law. But when the victims are Cuban, the culprits become people accused of terrorism. They become anti-Castro militants and also ex-terrorists.
You've used the term good terrorists versus bad terrorists. Does that tie into that whole theory?
Exactly. We know that that's the Bush doctrine, you know, the good and bad and the bad terrorist. But it's a doctrine also implemented by the French media, because they call Luis Posada Carriles as an anti-Castro militant. He's not an anti-Castro militant. If we want to know if Posada Carriles is guilty or not, we just have to read his book, his autobiographical book called Los Caminos del Guerrero, where he confesses that he has committed many terrorist acts. We also only have to read the interview he gave to the New York Times on July 12, 1998, where he took the responsibility, the intellectual responsibility for the 97 bombings in Cuba, in Havana. We also have to only have to read the declassified document of the FBI and the CIA. These documents were declassified on May 2005 and June 2005, and they recognize Posada Carriles as responsible for the 1976 bombing of this Cuban airplane.
We're speaking today with Salim Lamrani, who's from France. He's edited the book Superpower Principles, U.S. Terrorism Against Cuba. He's been talking about one of the terrorist that the United States coddles, Luis Posada Carriles, who is presently in custody in the United States. Carriles was responsible for the blowing up of a Cuban airliner, which killed 73 people back in 1976. He was recently picked up because he was plotting to assassinate Fidel Castro. Imprisoned, he escaped. He came to the United States and was put in detention, and there was a detention hearing recently concluded, and the United States government refused to marshal any of the evidence that it has against him, hoping that he would get a pass. They relied on witnesses from the New York Times, and the Times was reluctant to press the case of the government, and the immigration judge had no other choice, really, but to not do anything. So here the United States official policy is to not go after an admitted terrorist, as you point out. At the same time, the Cuban Five languish in five of the worst prisons in America.
And let's just remind our listeners that the Cuban Five are five men who came to the United States to learn more about terrorist activities aimed at their island. They went back to Cuba, presented voluminous information, which then the Cuban government invited the FBI to come. They turned over three large volumes and I believe some audio tapes. Instead of prosecuting the terrorist groups that were identified, this government arrested the Cuban Five on some relatively minor charge, such as having not the proper identification, but then also on larger charges of conspiracy to commit terrorism, to espionage, that were basically unfounded and little, if any, evidence. I don't think there was any evidence presented of the espionage charges.
Well, they didn't have to with a conspiracy charge. As our audience knows, it's really like a thought crime. And the conspiracy charge here was conspiracy to commit espionage sometime in the future, which is a charge that could only be acted upon by a jury in Miami because of their hostility to Cuban revolutionaries. And it was easy for the sort of people that sat on this jury, and we can go into that in a minute, what sort of people these were, because in Miami it's difficult to get a neutral juror. As a consequence, because of these people's prejudice, they were willing to say that the Cuban Five had talked about committing espionage in the future. I mean, how do you even defend yourself against a charge like that, particularly in Miami?
The prosecutor even confessed that it was impossible for him to prove that the Five came to the United States to commit espionage. He told that, he said that to the jury, and the jury, in spite of this confession, the jury recognized the Five guilty without asking one single question. Can you imagine that? That's the longest trial in the history of U.S. justice.
Yes, the trial was 7 months, and the jury was out for a mere 3.5 days.
Yeah.
They even the jury even told the press when they will release their verdict.
I didn't know that.
It shows that it's a political case because you don't know how long the discussion is going to take. They gave the date and the hour saying that we will give our verdict on that day and on that hour.
They knew what they were going to decide.
Exactly.
And I'm sure that when they were listening to those months of evidence, their decisions had already been made.
The defense lawyers asked the trial judge to change the venue, that is, to move the trial not even out of the state of Florida, but just up the coast 30 miles to Fort Lauderdale. The problem was the judge's husband was the attorney for North Miami. He wouldn't get reelected if the judge – that's the kind of way politics work in and around Miami. So she denied the motion. That order was appealed to the district court. And the district court took almost a year and wrote the longest decision in the history of America on the question of venue. And they came out in support of the Cuban Five. That decision was then appealed to the appellate court. And the appellate court recently overturned it in part. But they overturned it on the venue question, not because of the facts. I think that the appellate court really made a policy decision, that they weren't going to say that you can't get a fair trial in Miami, and they weren't going to give the Cuban revolutionaries a break.
Which is a stunning decision, given that a year before, the three-judge panel issued an 80- or 90-page decision where they examined even the interviews between the judge and potential jurors. And they, in this remarkable decision that the three-judge panel issued, said that the prejudice, the fear that these prospective jurors had, saying that they would be afraid to come out with a verdict of not guilty, illuminated the prejudices so indicative of the Miami feelings toward Cuba at that time. So they did a really careful analysis, and I think that Michael's correct. The only reason that decision could be overturned was one of policy against Cuba.
Exactly. I guess that's the first time. It's a very unusual reversal, the one that happened on August 9, 2006.
But Salim, let's talk about policy against Cuba. The imprisonment of the Cuban Five is just the latest outrage, really. In your wonderful book, Superpower Principles, U.S. Terrorism Against Cuba, you have noted authors like Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, Nadine Gordimer, Michael Parenti, Leonard Weinglass, the former ambassador to Cuba, Wayne Smith, Sol Landau. I mean,
our own Michael Smith, we must say, had a wonderful chapter in this book.
Exactly.
It's really a collection of some of the most knowledgeable people in the United States and Europe, in Gordimer's case, South Africa, and she knows something about terrorism, that one could imagine. And in the book, they outline the history of the United States' relations to Cuba since 1960, since right after the Cuban Revolution, never mind before 1960 when the United States supported the Batista dictatorship and some 20,000 Cubans were killed in their fight for independence. But starting with 1960, after the Cuban Revolution, there's been a constant war on Cuba by the United States, supported by the United States, and you've got a number of chapters in this book about that.
I'm going to give you some figures. Like between 1959 and 1997, the United States carried out 5,780 terrorist actions against Cuba. Terrorist attacks against Cuba have cost more than 3,000 lives and have left more than 2,000 people permanently disabled. The CIA has supported and directed over 4,000 individuals, 299 paramilitary groups. In 1971, after a biological attack against Cuba, 500,000 pigs had to be killed to prevent the spreading of the swine fever.
That was a swine fever epidemic that the United States launched on Cuba. Swine fever had never been endemic to the island of Cuba. Before that, the United States, through an agent, introduced dengue 2 fever into the Cuban population. It killed 153 people, including 101 children. It causes hemorrhaging, blood loss, and if you have blood loss and your blood doesn't get to the brain, you're deprived of oxygen, you go into shock, and the most vulnerable people to shock are our children. Killed 101 children.
And we introduced that into the
country. It was a germ from Fort Detrick, Maryland.
In 1981.
Biological warfare.
Eduardo Arocena, I guess, or Acerona, I don't remember his name, testified in a U.S. court that he introduced that germ, and he regretted because he said he didn't know that it was going to kill so many children. He testified on a U.S. court. He was arrested for other terrorist activities, and he testified on a court, I guess, in the late 80s.
Now, was this reported in the U.S. press?
Not at all. The bloody history of U.S. terrorism against Cuba has been completely silenced, not only by the U.S. press, but also by, let me tell you, by the European press in general and the French press in particular. I'm wondering, how can't we talk, how come don't we talk about the 1976 bombing, which was the first time a terrorist attack blew up an airplane, especially after 9/11?
What is your theory about why this is the case? Does it have to do with Cuba's continuing to challenge the ideology of a free market?
You know, the case of the Cuban Five is only one chapter in the history of U.S. aggression against Cuba. The real problem with Cuba is not Fidel Castro. It's not because they have one single political party. The real problem is the political, economic and social system of the island, which challenges capitalism and which proves that by following an alternative way, you can develop your country, your population will have a better standard of living.
Healthcare for everyone.
Healthcare, education.
They're living longer. And isn't the mortality rate in Cuba less than in the United States?
The mortality rate in Cuba is 5.7, and the mortality rate in the U.S. is 6.
Well, so that's for infants, and of course it's a lot worse in poorer neighborhoods like, say, the Bronx or Harlem. We're speaking here with Salim Lamrani, who's a French scholar, activist, and editor of this wonderful book, Superpower Principles, U.S. Terrorism Against Cuba. It's available on Amazon.com. For you folks that want to get it, I'd recommend it.
The publisher is Common Courage Press. The book, unfortunately, this book has also been censored by the U.S. media. But the book came out in several countries. It has 5 international editions. And
in what languages has Superpower Principles been published?
It has been published in Cuba in Spanish, in Spain in Spanish, in France, obviously, in Italy. And they're translating it in Germany and in Algeria.
Congratulations.
So, yes, that's fabulous. And we'll get the word out as much as we can.
Thank you.
Superpower Principles, U.S. Terrorism Against Cuba, edited by Salim Lamrani, Common Courage Press, Superpower Principles.
Over the past few weeks, events have been held around the country to raise awareness of the plight of the Cuban Five, 5 courageous men who uncovered information about plans by anti-Cuban terrorists to commit acts of violence against that island nation. After the Cuban government turned over voluminous documentation of such plans, the 5 were indicted and tried in Miami on unfounded charges of conspiracy to commit espionage, all without one page of evidence to corroborate such charges. The 5 had been imprisoned for 8 years in maximum security facilities around the country, unable to see their families, and in such remote locations that even visits from their attorneys are difficult. And of course, media coverage of their case has been nearly non-existent. Hopefully this will change, especially in light of recent revelations that the Bush administration has poured hundreds of thousands of dollars into paying Miami journalists to plant misleading and erroneous stories related to Cuba issues. In D.C., a large rally in March to the White House attracted 600 marchers and was followed by a panel of speakers, including Len Wineglass and Francisco Letelier, the son of Orlando Letelier, who, along with his assistant Ronnie Moffitt, was assassinated on the streets of Washington, D.C. in a brutal car bombing 3 decades ago, in the first act of international terrorism on U.S. soil. Also speaking at the panel was Livio De Selmo, whose brother Fabio was killed in a 1997 hotel bombing in Havana.
Our own Heidi Boghossian was also a speaker on that panel and at an earlier event in New York. She spoke welcoming Esteban Lazo Hernandez, the vice president of the Cuban Council of State. Let's take a listen to part of the New York talk given by Cuban Foreign Minister Felipe Perez Roque.
Victoria de la Revolución Cubana.
The victory of the Cuban Revolution
sobre las agresiones y el bloqueo,
over the aggressions and the blockade
es también la victoria,
is also the victory
de todos los que en el mundo,
of all those people who around the world
luchan y sueñan,
fight and dream
por un mundo de paz,
for a world of peace,
igualdad,
equality,
y justicia,
and justice
para todos,
for all.
No solo, no solo,
not only
entre los países, no solo,
not only among the countries,
sino dentro de los países,
but also within the countries.
Quisiéramos darle las gracias a ustedes.
We would like to extend our thanks to you
por sus muestras de solidaridad,
for your gestures of solidarity,
por su constante apoyo a la liberación de nuestros cinco héroes,
support for the release of our five heroes,
por su constante lucha porque se levante el bloqueo,
for your ongoing struggle in order to have the blockade in Cuba lifted,
y hemos venido también a celebrar,
we have also come here to celebrate,
a asegurarles a ustedes,
and to give you assurances,
de que nosotros derrotaremos el bloqueo,
that we will defeat the blockade,
ustedes y nosotros,
you and I and ourselves,
que nosotros lograremos que nosotros nosotros ustedes y nosotros,
that you and ourselves,
derrotaremos el bloqueo,
will defeat the blockade,
ustedes y nosotros,
you and ourselves,
liberaremos a nuestros cinco héroes,
will release our five heroes,
ustedes y nosotros,
you and ourselves,
lograremos que un día entre nuestros países,
we'll make sure that one day between our countries,
habrá relaciones normales,
there will be normal relations,
habrá una embajada cubana en Washington,
and there will be a Cuban embassy in Washington,
los habrá una embajada norteamericana en La Habana,
and there will be a U.S. embassy in Havana,
habrá comercio normal entre nuestros
there
países,
there will be normal trade between our two countries,
y los norteamericanos podrán viajar a Cuba sin que ello sea un delito,
and Americans will be able to travel to Cuba without that being a crime,
y los jóvenes cubanos podrán venir a estudiar este país,
and Cuban youths will be able to come to this country to study,
y los científicos de ambos países trabajarán juntos,
and the scientists from both countries will work together,
y los artistas de cada país podrán visitar
otros, and the artists of each country will be able,
sin las prohibiciones del bloqueo,
to visit one another without the prohibitions of the blockade,
y el pueblo norteamericano recibirá
and
de Cuba,
the American people will receive from Cuba,
información objetiva y veraz,
objective and truthful information,
y no la mentira y la propaganda,
and not the lies
con la que hoy
and the propaganda which are now being fed to them.
Un día,
one day,
el odio será derrotado,
hatred will be vanquished,
y prevalecerá la amistad,
and friendship will prevail,
el respeto,
as well as respect,
y la colaboración,
and cooperation,
entre nuestros gobiernos,
between our governments.
Un día,
one day,
los círculos de poder en este país,
the circles of power in this country,
tendrán que aceptar,
will have to accept,
el derecho de los cubanos,
the right of the Cuban,
a ser un país libre y soberano,
to be an independent and sovereign country,
como nosotros respetamos el derecho de este país,
in the same way that we respect this country's right,
para los cubanos,
for the Cubans,
mm-hmm. That was Cuban Foreign Minister Felipe Perez Roque speaking recently at the Church of the Intercession in New York City.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
The 2004 Ohio Presidential Electoral College slate became the first ever challenged in its entirety, leading to a historical debate in the U.S. Congress in January 2005. This past August, a civil rights action was filed, ordering 88 boards of election in that state to preserve their voting ballots. The filing says the ballots are needed as evidence of official fraud, manipulation, and discrimination that violated the rights of young and black voters. These ballots are essential to scholars and historians who hope to sort out the controversies and irregularities surrounding Ohio's 2004 election, a process that may take years and that requires preservation of the ballots. Republican election officials in Ohio, however, are pushing to destroy them. Joining us on Law and Disorder is attorney Bob Vitrakis, co-author with Steve Rosenfeld of the book What Happened in Ohio, a documentary record of theft and fraud, due out in a few weeks by the New Press. Bob, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be here.
So we've had some good news in Ohio. I hear there's a temporary reprieve on the destruction of the 2004 Ohio ballots.
Yeah, that came in the a group of inner city civic associations and other plaintiffs sued the Secretary of State, J. Kenneth Blackwell, and as a result of that, the ballots are being protected now.
Now, this is a temporary reprieve, correct?
Correct.
And how much time do we have?
Well, I think at this point it runs the course of the lawsuit. But there is a movement by historian Harvey Wasserman to get a permanent repository for all the ballots in Ohio.
Now, you have been part of a team of investigating the election evidence trail since the 2004 election.
Yeah, and in fact, the Columbus Institute for Contemporary Journalism provided a lot of the information that was used in this and other lawsuits. I was actually one of the attorneys in Moss v. Bush, which was the immediate election challenge.
What have you uncovered? What are some examples of potential fraud, errors?
I think in terms of the civil rights violation, from public records request, we found that 24.93% of all the people on the Cuyahoga County, which is Cleveland, on the Cleveland section of the Cuyahoga County voter registration list were purged between 2000 and 2004. Now, this is allowed under HAVA. There's a May provision. But what we also found is that in rural Republican counties, Miami County, Ohio, which is north of Dayton over in the southwest near the Indiana border, they not only did not purge, that they actually merged people from other counties and allowed them to vote even though they weren't registered in that county. And Miami County has about 2% African Americans. So we're finding disparate treatment, tremendous differences on whether you're living in a black majority city like Cleveland or in an overwhelmingly nearly all-white area like Miami County, Ohio.
Did it take you a while to piece this together?
Well, you know, we didn't get a lot of cooperation from the county boards of election. In fact, J. Kenneth Blackwell, the Secretary of State, told us we had to deal with county prosecutors. So historically, we've dealt with boards of elections, and we have a very strong public records law. For some reason, initially, it was because of the lawsuits following the 2004 election and the ongoing recount. But then it just seemed to stay in effect that instead of going and getting a routine public records request, because the Attorney General of the state had ruled that the ballots are public records, we ended up having to negotiate with these county prosecutors. But we've had these same problems throughout the state. In Claremont County, I spent countless hours negotiating to get the ballots copied, which they told us they didn't have enough manpower, which is one of the few outs under the public records law. They told us if we hired people, we could copy them, but we weren't going to set that precedent. But we did manage to get a random pull of 192 precincts in the county, and in a pull of one ballot from one precinct, in the middle of that precinct, we found a spoiled ballot. Dr. Ron Bayman had it taped, and we asked how many more spoiled ballots there are. And what we found is 36 straight people apparently came in and spoiled their ballot.
Now, what do you mean when you say spoiled the ballot?
They marked it wrong.
Right.
On an OptiScan, which is statistically has never happened in all my studies of ballots, where 36 consecutive people come in. The joke was they had spoiled the ballot by voting for Kerry. But we really think it suggests that some ballots were replaced. And then when we counted, we sent another team, and Dr. Richard Hayes Phillips was looking at it. We only found 5 spoiled ballots in the whole precinct. So we're trying to get an explanation of why there were 36 straight ballots and also why there was a sticker over a Kerry and Edwards mark on one of the ballots.
Now, has anyone been cooperating with you in this endeavor?
One county, Miami County, the director up there, Steve Quillen, who was appointed by the Republican, has really been quite open and let us go through the warehouse. So we have some irregularities in that county. They appear not to be covering them up. And also, they seem to be as puzzled by them as we are. And it may actually involve the counting machines, you know, what some people would call a computer glitch. is that it seems like there's possible errors in the software and the equipment that either counted the Opti scans or on the so-called central tabulator, which is nothing more than a PC with proprietary software in the 04 election from a company, ES&S.
Now, talking about the voting systems, since 2004, there are new voting systems in many Ohio counties, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
That Kenneth Blackwell put in place.
Yeah, they're mainly Diebold, a majority of them, you know, more than half the counties, the 88 counties, and then ES&S, and there's some other ones, Hardin or Civic, and there's also a few that went to OptiScan rather than the DREs.
Now, you've been critical of some of these systems. What's the problem with them?
The problem is that these election systems, these particularly these DREs, don't meet any minimal standard of transparency. That is, they're all running proprietary software where the source code is not known by the county or the state of Ohio. So in the case of a slot machine in Las Vegas, in Nevada, the state would control the source code in escrow, and everyone would know what was programmed into those machines and be able to match it. In Ohio, we have no clue whether the software or hardware in those machines actually matches that which was certified by the state or county.
Does a printed copy come out after someone votes?
Ohio law requires that they all have a voter-verified paper audit trail. They don't require that they have voter-verified paper ballots. And in many of these counties, what they have is essentially thermo paper, that stuff you get at the ATM machine. In fact, Diebold was a leading ATM maker where it got into the election.
Interesting.
So it makes it very difficult to read that paper for purposes of a recount.
And does a voter get to see a copy of that to make sure that it was printed accurately reflects the way he or she voted?
The only county I know where that happens, this is the home county we've operated out of, and they've admitted it was our pressure that did it here in Franklin County, it's the capital Columbus, is the only one where you get a simultaneous push and write out under plexiglass of who you voted for.
I'm curious why the push from the state to destroy the ballots. Doesn't it just seem reasonable to keep them since there have been lawsuits and disputes?
That was our point. Since the Secretary of State and the Republican Party has been on record saying it was a model election, of course we said a model, you know, of what, and that there were no irregularities, it would seem if there's a huge historical dispute. And now there's been many documentaries written and many books, an accusation of a stolen election or rigs or irregularities changing the election. You would think that all sides would have a vested interest in preserving the record for future scholars and historians. So I've never really understood the rush to destroy the ballots from the 2004 presidential election, because literally you'd be tripping over ballots that went back as far as 1976 in some of these warehouses to shred the ballots from 04.
Were some ballots destroyed?
Well, what was destroyed was, and this is very controversial because it's our contention, it's illegal under Ohio law, what they destroyed was the unused ballots. And in many cases, they destroyed the packing material and the count of how many unused ballots there were.
Right.
In order to tell whether a ballot box has been stuffed or mixed in accidentally, and we have found areas where they admit to accidentally mixing in extra ballots, you need to know not only how many ballots were cast, but you need to be able to count how many were unused
right.
as well.
Bob, you've also documented this whole experience in your forthcoming book, What Happened in Ohio, a documentary record of theft and fraud in the 2004 election. When is that due to come out?
I think the official release is October 20th, but it should be in stores.
Now, you're also running for governor of Ohio, aren't you?
As an independent endorsed by the Green Party.
What is your campaign platform going to be?
Well, not surprisingly, fair and honest elections and transparency. And as more than one person has pointed out, I now have legal standing to sue the
right.
state.
Right, certainly. Yes. In terms of the lawsuits that are pending, is the main one the one that was brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights?
That one remains in federal court from the 04 election. That is the remaining one. There is some suggestion that that may be amended to take on the question of voter IDs in Ohio in the 06 election, arguing that that also constitutes a pattern and practice of racial discrimination.
Bob, could you give us a few examples of the obstacles that you've encountered during this quest for justice, or examples of what you uncovered?
A couple things we uncovered were interesting. We have long contended that the 98.55% voter turnout in Miami County in Precinct Concord Southwest was not a true and accurate accounting.
That seems unusually high.
Right. I think it was Vanity Fair called it a Saddam Hussein-like turnout.
Right.
Usually we denounce these things when they happen in the third world. If we don't like the government here, we claim it's actually true. So when we went this summer to count in Miami County, we're about to look at the poll books and look at the signatures. The director hands us a list and says, you guys are right. It was only a 79% voter turnout. But he also went on to say, well, it didn't affect the election. And we're going, how is this possible? Because another precinct had a 94.25% turnout. And again, the story they told us is that it was the Boy Scouts. Well, the Boy Scouts mixed up some ballots from one precinct with another.
Were the Boy Scouts counting?
No, the Boy Scouts were apparently delivering ballots. The odd thing, which we like to put some people under oath, is exactly why weren't all the ballots that can only be used in the precinct, and why were the Boy Scouts bicycling them around Troy, Ohio? But then we went over to Delaware County, and we were auditing. A team of researchers was there. Stuart Wright was working under the Institute, and he's looking at a precinct, which had been unsealed. This is from election night. And he notices that, you know, the first 70 votes go to Bush. No more than four in a row ever go to Kerry. And then 200 votes go to Bush. And then the last 359 votes go to Bush.
Wow.
And we're trying to figure out how exactly. We were originally told that, and actually somebody at the New York Times bought this story when we were talking to him, but it's implausible. We were originally told, well, a couple buses showed up from churches. Well, we have the names of the people in the precinct. It's public record who's registered there. And unless they all live at the exact same address or within a very limited area, like living in a compound, some sort of church cult, people at churches don't all live at the same address or within a few blocks of each other.
No.
That didn't fly. But then they came up with a different story. As they looked in it, they told us the following, that the Republican presiding judge brought the ballots into the Board of Election, and as usual, the Boy Scouts, who always seem to be involved, took the ballots and brought them to, and this was the bizarre part, a, quote, mentally retarded man, end quote, who was hired to, quote, scrape the chads off the punch cards.
And how then, bizarre.
Yeah, very bizarre. And then it went to counting. Now, we ask about this, you know, quote, mentally retarded chad scraper, because we had determined from our own calculation he may have, in fact, been more of an idiot savant of chad scraping, because he would have had to have scraped 4 to 5 chads a second for 4 straight hours.
To do all that.
Yeah, because there's a timing when the ballots come in at 8 o'clock and when they posted them on their website. So it gets into one of those weird positions where you realize is that you may be deposing somebody who is mentally challenged, and it may have been deliberate by the Board of Elections in order to put you in that position. Exactly why did you hire a known, quote, mentally retarded man, end quote, to scrape chad?
Now, are there guidelines for who can be hired to scrape chads?
Well, what we find out is, under the law, scraping chads seems to be tampering with ballots.
Right.
But we found that in Delaware County as well as Warren County, Ohio, where they had declared their own level 10 Homeland Security alert and hid the ballots because Osama was in the neighborhood in a warehouse that was unauthorized. But we also found a ballot scraping crew there, email. But we also found there is that pink header cards, there's these bright pink cards that you use to delineate one precinct to another because they're all counted at the centralized Board of Election. And what we found is that somebody had actually one-punched the card, one punch on it, only for Bush.
And no other candidate.
Right, and it's not even a votable card, but it was counted.
And when you say it wasn't a votable card, you mean?
It's a bright pink header card, a marker card.
And those were counted.
Yes.
This is all very suspicious. Are these examples all delineated in your book? Or some of
most,
them?
Most of those are delineated. We have copies. It's the first book that at the end of the book, you'll see some actual ballots. We've since found other interesting patterns. We did a 1% sample in Cleveland, Akron, Cincinnati, the major urban areas that went, the African-American wards that went heaviest for Kerry. And what we're finding is a projected 20,000 ballots in those areas that were double-punched, overvotes, but almost all the overvotes were for John Kerry, which isn't surprising. Cleveland went 83% for Kerry, and these wards went 12-1 for Kerry. We also found what appears to be cards that were mixed up in Warren County. You can tell from the voting pattern. In fact, in one county, Bush is getting 60% of the pro-gay marriage vote and 70% of the African-American liberal judge from Cleveland. voters are also voting for him.
Right.
So just not likely to have happened.
Exactly.
So what looks like it happened is what they said, probably an accident. We moved these ballots from one precinct to the other, and there's ballot rotation in Ohio. So what was a 4 for Kerry in one precinct became a 4 for Bush if counted on a different machine.
Oh, my goodness. Bob, everything you've just said sort of drives home the importance of preserving these ballots.
In fact, I talked to Professor Krasnick at Stanford, who's leading ballot rotation expert, and he says, you know, scholars, you know, need those ballots. Historians, scholars, statisticians need to be able to preserve these ballots because it's a classic case of what went wrong in election. And what's also interesting is almost all the errors seem to have helped Bush and hurt John Kerry. On election eve, there were 138,000 votes for the president. And just certifying, and remember, almost all the counties, except for a few urban counties, are Republican-controlled counties. Just cleaning up the vote, Kerry picked up 19,000 votes.
Your forthcoming book, What Happened in Ohio, a documentary record of theft and fraud in the 2004 election. It sounds like it's going to contain some eye-opening evidence.
Oh, I think it will. It'll be out on the New Press. And we included many of J. Kenneth Blackwell's actual memos so people can get a feel of what went on in Ohio.
Bob, keep up the fabulous work. Good luck with your campaign, and thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Oh, yeah, thank you for having me on.
Bye-bye.
We want to welcome WHYS, Eau Claire, Wisconsin's community radio. That's 96.3 FM in Eau Claire. That's in my home state. I'm especially glad to welcome WHYS to Law and Disorder.
We'd also like to welcome WRCT 88.3 FM, the Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners. As real as it seems, the American
dream ain't nothing but another calculated scheme to get us locked up, shot up and back and chained. To deny us of the future, rob our name. Kept my history a mystery, but now I see the American dream wasn't meant for me. Cause Lady Liberty's a hypocrite, she lied to me. Promised me freedom, education, equality. Never gave me nothing but slavery. And now look at how dangerous you made me. Calling me a madman, cause I'm strong and bold. With this scuffle of knowledge of the lies you told. Promised me emancipation and this new nation. All you ever gave my people was salvation. Fathers of this country never cared for me. They kept my ancestors shackled up in slavery. And Uncle Sam never did a damn thing for me. Except lie about the facts in my history. So now I'm sitting here mad cause I'm unemployed. But the government's glad cause they enjoy when my people are down. So they can screw us around. Time to change the government now. Panther power. Panther power. American dream was an American nightmare. You kept my people down and refused to fight fair. Took the Klux Klan, tried to keep us out. We signed a truth and state no blacks allowed. With intimidation and segregation was the way for our freedom, but now we're impatient. Blacks, the other of skin, yeah, don't sell out. Freedom, equality, get out, yell out. Don't you never be ashamed of what you are. It's your Panther power that makes you a star. Panther power. Panther power. Panther power. My mother never let me forget my history. Hoping I was set free. Chains that were put on me. Wanted to be more than just free. Had to know the true facts about my history. I couldn't settle for being a statistic. Couldn't survive in this capitalistic government. Cause it was meant to hold us back. Using ignorance, drugs, the sneak attack. In my community, they killed the unity. But when I charge them, try to claim immunity. I strike America like a case of heart disease. Panther power is running through my arteries. Try to stop me, oh boy, you'll be clawed to death. Cause I'll be fighting for my freedom with my dying breath. Do you remember? That's what I'm asking you. You think you're living free? Don't make me laugh at you. Open your eyes, realize you've been locked in chains. Said you wasn't civilized and stole your name. Cause some time has passed, seem to all forget. There is no liberty for you and me, we ain't free yet. Panther power. Panther power. Panther power. Panther power. As it seems, the American dream ain't nothing but another calculated scheme to get us locked up, shot up and back and chained. To deny us of the future, rob our name. Kept my history a mystery, but now I see the American dream wasn't meant for me. Cause Lady Liberty's a hypocrite, she lied to me. Promised me freedom, education, equality. Never gave me nothing but slavery. And now look at how dangerous you made me. Calling me a madman, cause I'm strong and bold. With this scuffle of knowledge of the lies you told. Promised me emancipation and this new nation. All you ever gave my people was salvation. Fathers of this country never cared for me. They kept my ancestors shackled up in slavery. And Uncle Sam never did a damn thing for me. Except lie about the facts in my history. So now I'm sitting here mad cause I'm unemployed. But the government's glad cause they enjoy when my people are down. So they can screw us around. Time to change the government now. Panther power.
From the rebel to you.